Turn it back on again.
Okay.
Yes, your job.
Yeah, sorry. After having covered myself with water and embarrassment, the book was published in 93. I left Hawke's office in 91. I wrote it through 92. I was, you know, I suppose the faint commercial bone in my body was suggesting that if I got it out before the 93 election, it would be, it would boost, you know, it would be more noted. And I just couldn't finish it in time. It was a huge project, as it turned out. They always are. So it came out after the 93 election. And of course, Keating had won the 93 election against all of the kind of predictions of the gallery, and indeed as against my own expectations, and against the argument of the book, because the book ends with Hawke, you know, fighting off Keating's challenge by saying he's the only one who can, you know, win in 93. And then blow me down if Keating didn't win that absolutely magnificent fighting election in 93 and extend Labor's term in office. So the book came out after 93 when, you know, Hawke's prime ministership was already entering the pages of history, you know, which actually makes it all the more important. I mean, I think, I mean, Keating I've got a obviously huge respect for. I wish he had never knocked off an incumbent prime minister, I must say. And I think that there's been a lot of, after his prime ministership, a certain probably disproportionate focus on his role in the Hawke-Keating government as treasurer, probably at the expense of Hawke's role as prime minister through that whole period of time. And so again, you know, I feel as though the book justifies that. But anyway, it came out in, it must have been late 93 after the election. Oh, it came out mid to late 93.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think we probably have covered enough with Hawke. I wondered, could you talk a bit about the time you were in the office working for the Prime Minister? There were three chiefs of staff at that time: Chris Conway, then Sandy Holloway, and Dennis Richardson, I think, was the last one.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about them and how they influenced you and how that you worked with them.
Sure. Look, and they were just so critically important to the whole success of that office. So the Prime Minister's office was structured in a different way from how the offices have been structured, I guess, since Howard onwards. But we had the called Principal Private Secretary, and he was a career public servant. The first one had been Graham Evans, and he'd left before I arrived. But then, as you say, Conybeare, Holloway, Richardson were all PM&C, you know, senior departmental DEPSECs, I think, in each case. But so they were in the office on secondment. They were not political appointees. Many of us were. They were not. They were career public servants, and at the end of their time, they went back into the public service. So but they were not chief of staff. We didn't have this phrase chief of staff. That's what I want to emphasise. In a sense, the office had two heads. It had the principal private secretary, and it had the political advisor. Hopefully, we'll talk about the political advisor shortly. But the principal private secretary, you know, was across all of the paperwork, didn't touch the politics. The political advisor was obviously across all of the politics, and they both had equal standing. Certainly from my point of view as a staff member, they had equal seniority at the top of the tree, and it worked brilliantly. It obviously required very close coordination between the two of them, and a lot of give and take and flexibility, and you know, it was part of the genius of this whole office that the people who worked in it, as I think I said yesterday, but I mean, it was just such a magnificent team, collegial effort where everybody was focused not on individual, you know, kind of jostling, but on the bigger effort of Hawke. It makes it sound like a, you know, fairy tale, but it did actually work like that. So anyway, Conybeare, he was the one who, after Jeff Walsh had kind of approached me, he was the one who put in place my appointment. And I was I'd just published this earlier book, you know, as a journalist, The New Machine Men, and I but it hadn't yet appeared, and I was emphasising to Chris, look, you realise that I've got this book coming out, and it's about poles, and he was completely relaxed about that, and you know, so it proved there was no problem with it. What I really admired about Connie Bear, I'd just never seen anybody who could organise, you know, the maelstrom that was a Prime Minister's office. So well, I mean, if you think, you know, they're sitting there in that press of events, you know, Parliament sitting, you know, Cabinet might be sitting, you know, ministers are walking in and out saying, can I have 5 minutes with the Prime Minister? You know, there might be a foreign dignitary, you know, coming the next day, or a dinner to attend, or he might be travelling, or and so there are lots of competitions for time, but also there's obviously the evolving political and policy issues which are emerging. You know, a cabinet submission might be being developed on, you know, some proposal, and the principal private secretary has to be aware, you know, of all of this going on, and has to pretty well work out how to sequence those things so as the Prime Minister, sitting at his desk, you know, driving the whole ship, if you like, you know, so the Prime Minister gets things in the right order, and sees things clearly. You don't want a situation where, oh, Prime Minister, here's a decision you need to make, but it's contingent on five other things that you haven't seen yet and that we haven't quite developed. So, you know, if you make the decision, it's not going to be a good decision, you know. So you have to get all of those ducks in a row. Connie Bear was brilliant. So was Holway and Dennis Richardson in their turn. But I'd never seen this before, and I was just so impressed with Connie Bear, with his just calm ability to get all of those ducks in a row and make sure that the Prime Minister's decision making was, as I say, properly sequenced, properly structured. And I say Hawke had this nickname for him, which was affectionate and respectful, which was Field Marshal. Okay, Field Marshal, what have you got for me now? And it's a great name because, you know, he wasn't just a general, he was a field marshal across the entire, you know, army, as it were.
It sounds quite astounding that you managed to get the kind of cooperation between the two, his principal private secretary and the political advisor too, and still, yet I sense that it was the principal private secretary who had the ultimate coordinating role to make sure that what the Prime Minister got was the...
Let's talk about Connie Bear was, as it were, teamed with, or, you know, was coincided with Bob Sorby, who was the political advisor. Bob Sorby, I believe, is the most significantly underestimated player in the Hawke government at this time, in, you know, late 80s. Perhaps for his own reasons of reticence, he has never big-noted himself. But it was my observation that he was he was a critical player. He's a political advisor, of course, but he was very, very good at the job. Mm-hmm. Had a great relationship with Connie Bear. So, yeah, as I say, part of the complexity of Connie Bear's job was that if Sorby had an issue running, if Sorby needed to see the Prime Minister, he would walk in the door and see him. I mean, I'm sure they'd find out who's there first, but there was no... They were equal seniority, and in terms of access to the Prime Minister, I think they had equal rights of access. So this just made their job more complex, but it certainly meant that it is not true that, quote-unquote, the bureaucrats were running the office. The bureaucrats were running much of the policy agenda, as they probably should, but the politics was, you know, equally apparent, you know, represented by Sorby. Sorby had very cool judgment. He had a lot of experience. He'd worked for Rex Connor in the Whitlam government. I think he'd worked in the New South Wales government. He was a lawyer. He had been a barrister. He's now a judge in New South Wales. Lived in Sydney. In my very first kind of couple of months in the office, I was still living in Sydney. We hadn't yet moved down to Canberra. And so, you know, I would commute up on the Monday and fly back on the Friday, as did Sorby for that period of time. And so we would fly together and take the cars together. And I can remember commenting, and so we chatted a bit, and I can remember commenting that the fact that he was going back for the weekend and he didn't have, you know, five briefcases crammed with paper. In fact, he had just a little kind of grip type of briefcase, little leather bag, which didn't have much in it. And I said, you know, but he just said, I just don't take work home. I do it at work. If they want to contact me, they can contact me. And my job is to give advice. And if they don't like the advice, that's fine. So he had a very remarkable dispassion about the work, which is not to say he wasn't the most deeply committed, you know, partisan and Hawke promoter, notwithstanding his New South Wales, i.e. potentially Keating-esque background. I think he was a critical player in all of this period where Hawke, as we were talking about yesterday, was challenging the Labor Party to reform, and the, you know, the tariff debate was continuing, the privatisation debate was underway, and, you know, this was a big problem for the party, big problem for the Graham Richardsons of this world, big problem, you know, and Sorby was, across all of that, cool, phlegmatic. He was fantastic. I'll say this thing. When we were in Jerusalem on this international trip, and actually I think we mentioned yesterday the King David oration. No, the Hebrew University oration. We were staying in the King David Hotel. The Hebrew University speech was the big speech. And I was carrying the text with me as we headed off in the morning in the motorcade, had to go somewhere first for some official ceremony or something like that. And then we were going on to the university. And it was just when we were in the car that I was, you know, checking all of our, that I had everything. And then, needless to say, realised that I had 11 pages of the speech, but it was a 12-page speech. And the final page was nowhere on my body. And in fact, you know, we printed it out just before he left, and obviously the last page was on the wretched photocopier, on the wretched printer. So the party was off. It may have been a wreath laying or something like that, but I had to move quickly. So I told the driver, I've got to go back to the hotel, go back, pick it up. I couldn't tell anybody, so I disappeared. They didn't know where I was. They went on to the Hebrew University, knowing this big speech was coming up. Where's the goddamn speechwriter? Where's the speech? I was nosing my way without the benefit of motorcade and, you know, police and stuff like that, back to the, through the traffic, you know, back to the hotel, and then off to, he found the last bloody sheet of the speech, got back in the car, got to the university, got there in front of them. Whew, that was good. And so I was waiting for them as they approached, and they said, where the hell have you been? And where's the speech, don't you know? And stuff like that. And I explained what had happened. And Sorby, you know, phlegmatic, calm, he said, mate, just next time, tell a white man. Anyway, that's what he said. And so, you know, as with all of these things, you can fix the underlying problem, but you create another problem. I'd created the problem of them not knowing where I was, so I should have told somebody. Anyway, phlegmatic, calm, dispassion. And as I say, greatly underestimated in terms of his contribution to the success of that office and that Prime Minister.
What's the chemistry between the other two principal private secretaries and the other political advisers during that time? Was that as good as it?
Yeah, similar. So Sandy Holway probably overlapped. I mean, they were not perfect overlaps. Sandy must have overlapped with Sorby as well a bit, I think, but principally Geoff Walsh, and then Dennis Richardson and Col Parks. Well, I mean, look, the thing to say about the three private secretaries, just before we go, Connie Baird was, at the end of his stint, returned to PMC, went to the Immigration Department, headed up the Immigration Department, and in 1996, on the election of the Howard government, was one of the victims of Howard's Night of the Long Knives. And it was the most cruel, senseless, wickedly political decision to essentially terminate that man's career. And I think it's unforgivable. I don't think Howard has ever apologised. The reality is that apparently he was a victim of circumstances. He wasn't supposed to be targeted. The reality is he was targeted. His career basically came to an end. It was a disgrace. Connie Baird, you know, was a great public servant. Holway went on to head SOCOG. Richardson went on to have one of the most celebrated political public service careers, which continues to this day. He'd been head of immigration, been Washington ambassador, head of DFAT, now head of defence. You know, Chris Connie Baird, you know, has been working as a consultant outside the public servant. You know, I mean, I just think it's a.
Were they more or less the same disgrace. Age group?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, so relations with the political advisors. Yes, it was always good. That double-headed structure survived throughout the whole tenure of the Hawke. I mean, obviously Hawke liked, you know, having it structured that way, and they all got on, you know, in that kind of cooperative fashion. Yeah.
And so the three of the political advisors, you've already spoken a lot about Bob Sorby. Anything in particular you would like to mention about Geoff Walsh and Col Parks?
Well, Walsh, you know, was the one who got me into the job, and he's had a you know, hugely distinguished career in the Labour Party, and in the Prime Minister's offices, as well as in foreign affairs. You know, he kind of kept on coming in and out of politics, but he'd been Hawke's press secretary, then Hawke's political advisor, then Keating's political advisor, and then was ALP national secretary, having also been ALP communications director in the, I guess, early 80s. So really stellar career. So Walsh is a very good mate of mine. Says nothing, says absolutely nothing. He's silent. Wicked sense of humour, got a great capacity to use humour to diffuse situations, had an excellent insight into Hawke. I'll say, I mean, look, I mean, one, if we're talking stories, one story comes to mind. Hawke was a great cryptic crossword man, as was Walshy. And so I can remember, you know, on the times when I did travel with them, you know, sometimes the VIP would take off, and it was usually the Bulletin magazine, now since demise, but it had an excellent cryptic in there, and they would just hop into it, you know, and both of them very, you know, fast solvers of cryptics. I also like cryptics. I was never in their league, I must say, but I learned a lot while I was there, and so, you know, quite frequently you'd get you know, the first 15 minutes of the flight, you know, they'd both be working on their respective copies of the Bulletin and solving these cryptics. On one day, this is in the new Parliament House, I was I think it was the Australian cryptic, and it must have been a quiet morning because anyway, I was doing the crossword. I got up from my desk. I had to go somewhere. Maybe I went to the bathroom. I don't know. And I'd got most of this crossword out, but there were three or four which I just couldn't nut out. When I came back to my desk, there on the desk, the crossword was solved by the Prime Minister himself. He'd apparently come in with Jeff looking for me for, you know, some discussion about something. Found I wasn't there, found this incomplete crossword, immediately attacked it, solved it, found that I'd made a mistake in there, and not only solved it, but left a message for me, which was explaining what he'd done, and he included in the sentence all of the words which were in the new clues that he'd found. So, you know, it was just kind of like that, and I've kept that somewhere. God, no, I haven't seen it for ages, but it was just, you know, hilarious. So we had, you know, this is Hawke's competitive nature, by the way, as well as his, you know, good team fun.
Col Parks,
having lunch with him today, in fact. Col also he had been a journalist, so I'd known Col back in the Fairfax Press Gallery days, or, you know, up in our Senate corridor, because he used to be the correspondent for the old Sydney Sun, the afternoon paper, before it shut down. So I've probably known him since, late 70s or early 80s, whenever I was in the gallery. You know, famously well-connected, tough, solid. He'd also come up through the Hawke Press office, so he'd been Hawke's press secretary, I guess, after Jeff Walsh, I'm guessing here. There was also Grant Nile, who worked in the press office, and I can't quite recall who was press secretary first, Nile or Col Parks.
What about John Bowen?
John Bowen.
He was a foreign policy advisor.
Yes, right? Yeah. Well, has been described, what was described by the Prime Minister himself as that gem of a man. I think that's the word that he uses that Hawke uses in his own biography. And it's a good word because it's sparkling, multifaceted, multi-talented bloke. So he was the foreign policy advisor, and in the old Parliament House, his desk was a chaos of paperwork. Hawke's desk was brilliantly clean. All of our desks were loaded with shit and papers and stuff like that. And John in particular, in these days, cables were actual telex documents. They were long pieces of, well, not long. They had been telexed in from the various posts and then would come in, you know, kind of A4 printouts. But, you know, there were, thousands of sheets of paper on his desk, you know, photocopied together, and he could always find it. You know, as one of those people, you know, for whom it was a creative mess, but a beautifully structured one. But also in his office was all of the sporting memorabilia, because as well as being this foreign policy expert, he was and is a sports nut. He was the one who when Hawke was selecting the team for the Prime Minister's 11 cricket match, which was revived under this Prime Minister, John was the one who knew that there was some up and coming batsman from WA, you know, who was 19 years old but should, you know, get a Guernsey in the PM's 11. It was always the team was a combination of seniority and youthful inexperience, and Bowen helped pick that team. But Bowen had boxed at school, but otherwise, and played cricket obviously, but otherwise was not a big sporting person, didn't play golf, but knew and still does, you know, follows all codes of football, and cricket in particular, incredibly closely, all forms of Olympic activity. John was one of the former Hawke staffers, along with Sandy Holloway and Simon Ballston, whom we should mention as well, who went on to SOCOG, the Sydney Organising Committee for the Olympic Games. Holloway, of course, was the CEO of that organisation, and Bowen and Ballston, you know, were crucial players in the success of the Sydney Olympics. So Bowen was also, I should say, yeah, Bowen was a tennis player. We played a lot of tennis in the office.
Inside your little office?
No, not inside the office, but if we look out this window, Edward, as we sit here, we can see the Reps Lawn Tennis Court, and I played many happy games of tennis there with Chris Conybear, his wife Lynn, who was a very handy player, Bowen, who else? John Nicholson. You know, we would organise this on a weekend, book the court, come in, play for a couple of hours. Ozzy Menegello, of course, who we should mention, the kind of Hawks butler. He was a good tennis player as well. He used to play whilst smoking, which was always a good sight. And this predated me, this story, but so I can't vouch for its accuracy. But playing at weekends, obviously, Parliament was not open. And so apparently on one day they turned up for a game of tennis out here in the Reps Court, found that they didn't have somebody's racket. It was actually up in Bowen's office, along with all of the cables, the tennis rackets, the, you know, other sporting junk, the cricket balls and so forth. And it was discovered, I'm not sure if it was actually done, but it may have been, I don't know, but rather than, you know, the long way round, going all the way round to the basement at the front door to get in and then go down and unlock the Prime Minister's office and get this tennis racket, probably it would be possible to go in by the back entrance here. There's a back steps that go from the outside the Reps door here up to the PM's office, up a little flight of steps. If you could get in that door, run up the steps, run down to Bowen's office, grab the tennis racket, run back down the steps and out the door before the alarm went off, you could save yourself a lot of time. So the John Bowen Memorial Dash, as I say, I'm not certain if it ever happened.
It's a good story, even if it did or not.
Bowen also, I mean, let me just go on. Bowen also was a fantastic lover of classical music. He had a very good bass voice and an encyclopedic knowledge of music. He was the one who, when the Prime Minister was making some overseas tour, would schedule whatever the cultural event was. I remember once in what's that place in Croatia on the coast?
Split?
No, we didn't go to Split. It was to the big wall, Dubrovnik, in this ancient building in Dubrovnik, scheduled a gorgeous piano and cello little concert. It was, you know, just attended by Hawk, his official party, some of the local Yugoslavians, as they then were, government officials. It was gorgeous. Bob, I must say, listened to the entire concert in deep meditation mode with his eyes firmly shut. But it had been a, you know, busy day. Anyway, Bowen is Bowen subsequently organised or chaired the Sydney University Graduate Choir, and he's still a chorister. Okay, enough about John. Wonderful man.
Yeah. Economic advisor Craig Emerson is one who.
Oh yeah. Craig, who is of course now the Trade Minister. You know, these. Well, it's also worth pointing out the economic advisors from Hawke's office. I mentioned Dennis Richardson's stellar public service career. If you think of Ross Garnaut, who was Hawke's first advisor, then Steve Sedgwick, who was there with me, who's now the Public Service Commissioner, succeeded by Rod Sims, who is the ACCC commissioner. And there was also, and then they were the senior economic advisors. Then there was Dr. Craig Emerson, who went on to trade minister. There was also Peter Harris, who was one of the DLOs in the office, who's just been appointed productivity commissioner. So, I mean, you know, these are not trivial. These are very serious policy specialists for whom policy is important, and they've got credentials, but who also understand the political environment in which policy is made. So, I mean, I just don't think it's any coincidence. I think they are all incredibly deserved appointments, and they recognise that great skill set that they, you know, demonstrate in Hawke's office. So maybe I'm bragging a little bit about, you know, on their behalf, but I just don't think it's coincidental that all of these guys have gone on to much bigger and greater things. Anyway, so Craig was really critical in the structure of the office. Well, I suppose they all were, but I mean, Craig played this unique role. So he was, Hawke regarded him very fondly, recognised his economic credentials. He had a PhD from ANU. Garno had been his supervisor. But he also had a, you know, big political brain as well, Craig. And so Craig often travelled with Hawke. You know, Craig was part of the travelling party. And I can remember in one occasion in the, I guess, 90 election, where there was, during the campaign, you know, there was a real scramble to pull together a substantial policy document about what the next term of government was going to be. And I can remember I got the call from Craig reasonably late one night. You know, I just had this meeting with the boss. We need to, you know, pull together all of this. He had half a dozen points. I added a couple more, you know, I think this was very good staff work is why I'm giving the story, especially by Craig, but I contributed to it as well. You know, there's all of this stuff out there. It's not secret. It's not unknown. But you've got to assemble it, package it, structure it. And so we worked on that, you know, overnight and I guess the next day, and it turned into a, you know, a good speech, I think, at Ballarat, where, you know, some structure was put around the next term agenda. So Craig did stuff like that. I think I also mentioned yesterday he did the kind of briefing book and the quotes book and stuff like that. So he was very good. We used to joke on the international trips because we were low down the pecking order in terms of the, you know, strict hierarchy of these things. And we always used to get in car 13, you know, it used to be pretty much towards about as close to the back end of the motorcade as you could be without falling off the back of it. So car 13 is where we belonged to be.
What do you have, did you have that much to do with Hawke's press secretaries? I believe you mentioned two names there, Barry Cassidy and Grant Niall.
Yeah. Look, you know, it's odd because they were physically separated from us in terms of their office was up in the press gallery. So we didn't see them on a, you know, second by second basis as we saw everybody else in the office downstairs. So, you know, they were always present, didn't impinge hugely on me. I mean, they often had input into speeches, Barry, Grant, you know, into suggesting phrases and so forth. Lou Cullen was the kind of, and Jenny Hunter before that were, you know, and Liz Dale were three women who, you know, did a lot of the, you know, just the brutal grunt work of that kind of office, you know, producing transcripts late at night and, you know, being responsible for organising logistics of press conference and so forth. I mean, God, it's hard work. Still, I always had smiles on their faces. Can I just flip back to say something about Sandy as well? Sandy, as principal private secretary in our office. Great kind of social innovator and great team builder. And so Sandy inaugurated the Friday afternoon cocktails in the new Parliament House, which certainly didn't happen every Friday, but on some Fridays he would appear in the general office bearing this gigantic tray of various exotic cocktails, which we would consume at, you know, the appropriate time at, on a Friday afternoon. But he also initiated the staff kind of social club, which we called the Glee Club. Why we call it the Glee? Anyway, it was called the Glee Club. And, you know, you'd put a couple of bucks in and occasionally buy drinks. But we also had an annual Christmas dinner. And, you know, I mean, I think it's probably worth mentioning this just because we were good friends in this office and capable of having a really good time together. In the normal press of times, the office would never be together. Everybody's travelling or doing different stuff or busy or, you know, stuff like that. But we did get together for this annual Christmas party. I can remember one was down here at the lobby restaurant. And, you know, everybody's contributed money and then we have a dinner and drinks and we have drinks and we probably have more drinks. And we have Sandy would present, you know, funny awards to people for various things. On one occasion, John Bowen and